Well, the Bronx has taken its seat on the bench. The new term of the U.S. Supreme Court started yesterday. Today, they're taking up a case involving the legality of distributing dogfighting videos.
For centuries, the American pit bull terrier has reigned supreme as the gladiator of the pit. You will see pit matches from around the world.
Videos like that. We'll hear how that may be a free speech issue. We'll also take a look at the most interesting of the other cases on the docket this term. Also, how will the newest justice, the Bronx's own, Sonia Sotomayor, influence the court? Well, joining me for a rundown of the new term of the U.S. Supreme Court, including how in heaven's name they could reject 2,000 cases in one workday, which they did yesterday, is Jamie Floyd, the host of Best Defense on True TV. You've also heard her as a guest host on this show. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Brian.
So today the court is taking up this case involving the distribution of dogfighting videos. Let's start there and tell me how this is considered a free speech case.
Well, it actually starts out on the court's criminal docket because, of course, the man who made and distributed the film is charged with a crime. And many First Amendment cases start out that way, but ultimately and at their core, they become First Amendment cases. And the question is whether or not he has a First Amendment right as a filmmaker to distribute his film in states where the activities depicted therein are illegal. Now, what makes the case, I think, most interesting is that he is not engaged in the dogfighting. He doesn't arrange for the fights. He doesn't participate in them. These are not his dogs. And, in fact, he has filmed these fights in places where dogfighting is legal. In fact, many of them overseas. So it becomes a very complicated case for the court. And it's something that they have had to contend with over the years in other contexts. It's an age-old question where we have distasteful movies, videos. The I know it when I see it obscenity standard, of course, has long ago been thrown out, and we've heard the folklore, which is in fact rooted in truth, of the justices sitting in their movie theater watching very offensive videos and movies to determine whether they are protected by the First Amendment. Does it have artistic, scientific, or other merit? So the question is whether this does or whether the law at hand is too broad. And you know, most analysts say, Brian, the law here is probably too broad and that ultimately, however much we may find offensive the material in these films, the films will probably be protected by the First Amendment.
Listeners, have you been following this dogfighting video case? Do you want to weigh in? Anybody in the animal rights community or free speech community or anyone else? 212-433-WNYC. Civil libertarians who are also animal rights activists, where do you come down on this? 212-433-9692. Or you can call with anything else about the new Supreme Court term for Jamie Floyd, who watches SCOTUS, as they call it with the acronym for Best Defense. Do we only say that in journalism? Nobody else in America says
it. In Washington, D.C., it's POTUS for the president and FLOTUS for the first lady and SCOTUS for the Supreme Court. So it's not just us, Brian.
POTUS of the United States. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Is it illegal for the public to view these videos, or is it just illegal to distribute and presumably make money off of them?
Well, the law has to regulate the activity of distribution and sale. And so that's really what the law focuses on. You can't really go after the viewing, or you'd have to storm into people's homes and actively remove the video, or I guess now I'm dating myself, the DVD, or I guess even that's dating myself,
the
right?
The file.
The file from one's computer, and that starts to become very scary, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, but in the case of child pornography,
right.
If you view it, I think you are legally liable, aren't
you? That is correct. And the court has, Brian, carved out very limited exceptions to our First Amendment rights, and child pornography is one of those. And the question is whether or not crush videos, and this is one of the things the court will be considering in the context of this case, or this kind of film, watching pit bulls and other animals, dogs in particular, engage in these kinds of fights, should also be entitled to some sort of exception. But, of course, if we continue to carve out exceptions, then the exceptions begin to swallow up the rule.
That
and that
term,
is what the argument will be
right.
today.
That term you used, crush videos?
Yes. Well, that refers to a market there seems to be in which women trample small animals either with their bare feet or wearing high heels. And apparently some viewers of these find that arousing, sexually arousing, and there is a black market for that.
How gross is that?
Well, it's very gross, but unfortunately this is what, oddly enough, these justices will have to consider, and there will be argument about that today.
Did Sonia Sotomayor realize what she was getting herself into?
I imagine she's a rather sophisticated woman, so
yes.
I think she can handle it. But they've been asked to watch some of this stuff as well, Brian, and they will have to watch this film if they have not already, and probably watch it multiple times.
Let me play two clips which lay out the basic arguments in a nutshell. Here is Patricia Millett, a representative for the defendant in the case, the distributor of the videos, Robert Stevens.
The whole point of a constitution is that it's not supposed to change just because a majority in Congress decides that it no longer thinks these images are, on balance, worthwhile. That's a pretty empty First Amendment.
And that's from an interview with NPR's Nina Totenberg. And here's the other side from Wayne Pacelli, head of the Humane Society, on why he thinks regulating these videos can be consistent with the First Amendment.
This is not speech. This is commercial activity of a sickening and barbaric type. And the peddlers of this smut should find no safe harbor for it in the First Amendment. The courts have recognized that certain well-defined and narrowly limited classes of speech play no essential part of any exposition of ideas and are of such slight social value that they may be regulated based on their content consistent with the First Amendment.
So, John in Fort Greene, what side are you on?
I'm a total animal lover and all that, but that's not what the Constitution says. And if the crime is the abuse of the dogs, fine. But
right.
I can go to the movies and watch people blowing up people in action movies, and we abhor blowing up people, so are we now going to ban those movies?
Well, but that's a fake blowing up of people, right? This is real trampling on the dogs.
In child pornography, if you make a animated movie or you have adults in pigtails, that's still criminal.
All right. And you also made another point to our screener, which I thought was really interesting, which is that we played a clip. So,
well, you're journalists. You, of course, you can see it. We just don't trust the common person out there.
Interesting point, Jamie Floyd.
Well, and there's another very well-known movie called Off the Chain, which was made by a hip-hop artist here in America. He is also a part of the community of pit bull fighting and has made a documentary. He's not a fan of the fighting, and he's not been called or hauled before the U.S. Supreme Court and all the courts along the way, only because his point of view is different, Brian. But I've seen the film, and I have to tell you, the material in his film is truly stomach-churning. It's, I'm sure, quite comparable to the film that the U.S. Supreme Court, the films that the court is considering today. But it becomes very difficult, I think, and I agree with our caller from Fort Greene, to begin to make choices between which films we're going to allow and which ones we're not based on our own personal point of view about the point of view of the filmmaker, especially when it's such a fine line between what that filmmaker may be trying to say.
Joe in Blairstown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was just, wondering how this relates to other types of that entertainment, such as bullfighting, which is which can also be really repulsive and, you know, terrible. It's alive, you know, killing of animals just, you know, for entertainment. It seems like it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I think I read the other day that Spain, by the way, is actually considering banning bullfighting after all these years. So that would be a change in the tradition over there, if that is true. But what about bullfighting? Is the difference that bullfighting is currently legal, Jamie?
Well, it's legal, obviously, in the venue where the bullfight occurs, but so, too, is the pit bull fighting in the venue where this filmmaker made his film, China.
That's an important... So that's a legally very important point,
yes,
isn't it?
It is for the defendant in this case, the respondent, as he's known in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And I think it's a very, very good argument that one could make in oral argument before the court. And I don't think they're listening to us because surely they're preparing for argument. But that slippery slope, and I know I've heard arguments about various artistic films in which animals are killed. Arnold Schwarzenegger's film, not Terminator, but one of the others in which an animal is killed. Of course, not really killed. It's all done with digital and artistic animation.
Uh-huh.
But you can clearly see where the slippery slope goes, as our caller suggests, and bullfighting would certainly be a very, very good example. I think the caller from Fort Greene, the previous caller, made a very good point that one should argue to the U.S. Supreme Court in the First Amendment context that you want to target the criminal behavior that underlies the film if indeed you want to ban animal abuse. You don't want to target the First Amendment depiction of that criminal behavior.
Jamie Floyd, my guest on WNYC, host of Best Defense on True TV, as we talk about the first couple of days of the brand new Supreme Court session and the first involving the brand new justice from the Bronx, Sonia Sotomayor. One of the other big cases the court has accepted so far is the Chicago gun rights case, the implications of which potentially go far beyond even just gun rights. Tell us about this one.
Well, of course, last year they had the Washington, D.C. gun ban, and I think many people were very surprised when they upheld, essentially, the right of the citizens there to bear arms. We like that expression, don't we? The Second Amendment right to bear arms. But that, of course, involved folks who live in the District of Columbia, which is not a it's a federal jurisdiction, essentially. So now we're in Chicago, and we're talking about a city municipality, which is essentially a state. We're talking about state and city right to regulate the Second Amendment. And so now, Brian, and this goes to, I think, what your point is, we're talking about state rights versus federal rights, the age-old debate in this country. Can the state tell you what to do, or does the federal government tell you what to do? And so it has to do with, and I don't want to get too inside baseball, it has to do with the 14th Amendment and the application of the Bill of Rights to the states. The Second Amendment right to bear arms, and how does it apply to the states? Can the states take away your right to carry a gun if the U.S. Supreme Court has said now that you have a Second Amendment right to carry a gun? What does that mean for abortion? What does it mean for gay marriage? What does it mean for sexual privacy? Could the U.S. Supreme Court use this case? And some scholars, and in fact there's an amicus brief that has been filed along these lines by some very, very well-noted law professors, a half dozen of them, could they use this case to rethink what that means to apply the 14th Amendment? We call it the Privileges or Immunities Clause. There's also something called the Due Process Clause, the way in which we apply the Bill of Rights to the states. Now, I really don't think it's going to happen, Brian, but there's a lot of chitter-chatter amongst we big-headed lawyers about what this could mean. The law geeks of America are very excited about what the implications of the case could be beyond just the Second Amendment. And just the Second Amendment implications are big, but it could be an even bigger case than that.
And I think outside of you law geeks, the average listener is probably shocked to even hear that the Bill of Rights may not apply fully under all circumstances in the United States. So, for example, I mean, the right to the you know, basic First Amendment rights, like the right to free speech.
Right.
A state, you know, the state of Arkansas could not decide tomorrow that it wanted to ban certain kinds of speech that the federal government has found protected under the Constitution, could it?
Well, if you go and read your Bill of Rights, which I urge all Americans to do, shockingly, we don't. We don't read these things in high school or grade school anymore. Civics classes have disappeared from much of the curriculum. But it says Congress, most of the amendments say Congress shall make no law to
right.
abridge, for example, your freedom of speech.
Right.
And so that means Congress. Those folks there on Capitol Hill. And so when I went to law school, I was shocked to learn that I had to take a whole year, Brian, of constitutional law to learn about the ways in which the Bill of Rights had to be incorporated. What that means is applied to the states. There's an entire breadth of law that the justices, like Sotomayor and Chief Justice Roberts and Scalia, they really get this. About how the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, getting back to the case you asked me about,
mm-hmm.
applies to the state legislatures and to all of the citizens who live in the states. And that's what this case,
right.
this is why when you hear about a case like the Chicago gun case, it's really going to be about
yeah.
how the Second Amendment and the federal law applies to the states. It's going to be about the incorporation doctrine. Boring to most lay people, because we want to talk about guns, don't we? And we want to talk about our right to carry them, or we want to talk about banning them if we're on the other
yes.
side of that issue.
Right.
But really, the opinion that comes down is going to be about the due process clause
yes.
or the privileges and immunities clause that we find in the 14th Amendment. And that's why we lawyers go to law school and read all of those boring documents that we read so that we can become Supreme Court justices and understand the incorporation clause so that when a case like this comes along, we can apply it to the Chicago handgun ban. That's what this case is really all about.
And here is a lawyer and NRA member, Phil from Queens, calling in. Hi,
great.
Phil.
Great.
Phil?
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
The Civil War amendments really apply the Bill of Rights to the states. It's not to be contested, and I think the Chicago law is going to go down. And quite frankly, it was my understanding that a bunch of the ACLU organizations and the women's rights organizations want this outcome. They want the Bill of Rights applied to the states. I mean, if the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states, we would be in a lot of trouble. Our society would be in terrible shape. So you're going to get the good with the bad. You have to remember that 40 states already out of the 50 have passed must-issue concealed carry weapons. I don't even think Chicago gets to that. I think Chicago really prohibits people from even, you know, having handguns in their home to go to target practice and things like that. So I think it's going to be a new day in America. But I have a quick question about whether Berg versus Obama and the other 17 or 18 cases survived. They were on Souter's calendar, and now Sotomayor has inherited those. Are those birth certificate cases going forward?
Very, very briefly on that, Jamie, to make it, you know, relevant to all the listeners.
You know, I'm not sure about the birth certificate cases. It's a great question, and I should have done my homework on that. I do know that they had those 2,000 cases on the docket over the summer that they disposed of, and as you said, Brian, in a day, and they have one, at least one, that they took no action on Monday, the Guantanamo Bay case, that they will have to have a conference on later this week, and I would imagine, Brian, that they are going to deal with some of those suitor matters in that conference. But that really is speculation on my part.
Jamie, in law school, do you learn speed judging? Because they must be reading like 16 cases an hour and deciding
What you do learn, you learn the secret of the Supreme Court, and it is the law clerk. Each judge has a bevy of very brilliant law clerks, and the law clerks really are vital to the functioning of the court. And they do a tremendous amount of work behind the scenes, and I know the justices are indebted to those law clerks. It's really a well-oiled machine up there, and they take the best and the brightest of the law students from around the country to help the chambers of each justice function.
We're over time, but it's great to hear you talk about this stuff, and I want to bring up one other as we finish up with Jamie Floyd, the host of Best Defense on True TV on the beginning of a new Supreme Court session. The justices will hear arguments as to whether it's legal to sentence a minor to life without parole.
I'm so glad you brought that up. The court and the much more conservative court under Chief Justice Rehnquist, before the current balance, has already said that it's unconstitutional to execute someone who was a juvenile at the time of his offense. So if a juvenile committed murder, he could not be executed. And they cited all kinds of science related to the brain development of juveniles, etc. The same arguments are now being made about a juvenile who commits a crime who is eligible for life without parole, meaning that he was tried as an adult, even though he was a juvenile when he committed his offense. And the cases on the docket are not murder cases. So there is sort of a double whammy, not a murder case, and the person is a juvenile at the time he commits his offense. We are the only Western country that would make a child eligible for life in prison without any possibility for parole. That means that we don't think children can be, I know I'm editorializing, but we don't think children can be rehabilitated. And we are a system that claims to be about rehabilitation, even for adults. So I would think even this closely divided court will reconsider, especially based on its own precedent, on the earlier decision for children in the death penalty.
Two minors in Florida, each convicted of violent crimes and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
And terrible facts, Brian, terrible facts. You just have to admit that up front. But I think the court will look at its own jurisprudence and reconsider.
And consider whether it's cruel and unusual punishment as the Constitution defines it. Okay, Jamie Floyd, Best Defense host on True TV, sometimes guest host on this show. Thank you so much. Really, really informative.
Thank you. My treat.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, 30 Issues in 30 Days, our New York, New Jersey election series. Issue 12, the Xanadu Meadowlands Project, stuck in the swamp. Stay with us.